president just calls for more sacrifice. But who will do the sacrificing? President Bush has so far, in mid-2004, requested nearly $200 billion to pay for the American war, occupation, and reconstruction of Iraq. News reports already revealed the comparative costs and sacrifices of this enormous expenditure. The entire proposed fiscal year discretionary budget for the Department of Health and Human Services is $66 billion. For the Department of Education, $53 billion. The total amount for all 50 states to meet their projected budget shortfalls this year is $78 billion. Meanwhile, the administration now projects the federal deficit to rise to as much as $521 billion in 2004. Who else was being forced to sacrifice was made clear in a Department of Defense announcement the day after one of the president's speeches. Thousands of National Guard and Reserves, who had been expecting their one-year call-up to end this fall, had their duty extended for up to another year. The ongoing occupation of Iraq has changed everything for many American families. And then there are the continuing casualties. Deadly attacks occur every day, while American families nervously await news from Iraq. Who will bear no sacrifices is also clear. The beneficiaries of the Bush tax cuts and the recipients of the lucrative contracts for Iraqi reconstruction, which are going to carefully selected American corporations like Halliburton, where Dick Cheney was the former chairman of the board. Those who will not sacrifice, in other words, are the wealthy and powerful allies of the Bush administration and its core constituency. It is not hyperbole to say that those beneficiaries of wartime tax cuts and contract deals should be called war profiteers. The record deficits under this Republican White House and Congress have been caused by three factors. First, the economic downturn, then the huge increases in military spending, and finally, the enormous tax cuts that the Bush administration wants to make permanent. Stephen Mufson, who covered economic policy for the Washington Post, has called the billions for the occupation of Iraq chump change, compared to what has been given away in the Bush tax cuts to the wealthy. Only 5% of the costs of the president's tax cuts over 10 years. If politics is the allocation of power, resources, and sacrifices, the politics of the sacrifices for the war on terrorism are becoming increasingly clear. It is high time for the White House to admit its miscalculations and policy failures. And those responsible for the failures should be the first to sacrifice. Therefore, the chief architects of the failed Iraqi policy, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz, should both be asked to resign. These chief unilateralists have presided over the policy failures and, if a better direction of international cooperation is to be restored in Iraq, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz must step aside. Removing these hardliners would open the way for greater involvement by the United Nations. It is clear that the only way other countries will contribute peacekeeping troops and reconstruction aid is if there is genuine UN control of the political and military situation. Economist Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University has controversially claimed that a UN reconstruction of Iraq would be far less costly, bringing political stability much sooner and allowing Iraq's economy and oil industry to get up and running more quickly. He predicts only about $10 billion. That would leave many more resources to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria in Africa, and for critical economic development in poor countries across the globe. And if the White House's calls for sacrifice are to have any moral credibility, the administration's tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans must be immediately rescinded, and the no-bid contracts to U.S. corporations favored by the Bush administration, like Halliburton and Bechtel, must be suspended. Neither the poor nor our children and their children should be forced to pay for the war in Iraq, while those with the greatest ability to sacrifice are reaping a world of benefit. That is morally unconscionable, and the only responsible course of action now is to repeal the egregious tax cuts and honestly seek international assistance in rebuilding Iraq. The administration's plans to increase deployment with nearly 140,000 troops through the end of 2005 are not the solution. It will, if anything, make the situation worse. Here is the real issue. The Americans and the British cannot and should not run Iraq. The American-led occupation is leading to more suffering on all sides, and it will just get worse. The unilateral American occupation must be stopped, and the rebuilding of Iraq begun, but under international authority and control. The United Nations was never given the full political authority to appoint a transitional Iraqi government and lead the process to clear elections and real Iraqi sovereignty. Security is, indeed, the immediate question, but a unilateral American military presence will never be able to provide it. We are the targets now, and the biggest cause of the security problem. The international community must not simply be brought in to help the U.S. agenda succeed. It must be given the authority to repair Iraq. American occupation is not the solution. It is the problem, and it must end. America finally found Saddam, but have we found safety or security? More and more say we are less and less secure, both in Iraq and at home, as long as the American occupation continues. Saddam should be brought to justice in the kind of fair trial he never gave others. The Iraqis should be the primary ones to hold him accountable for his horrendous crimes, but the international community should have an important part to play as well. The Bush administration should finally move to genuinely internationalize the peacemaking and decision-making strategy in Iraq, and allow the United Nations to oversee the process of writing constitutions and having elections. They are simply better at it than we are. The capture of Saddam should have marked the beginning of genuine nation building. If the Americans would have given up their control and allowed other nations to help shape and secure a new Iraq. But the United States seems to savor its more imperial style. Yet, if we take Mary seriously, Pax Americana not only won't work, it won't ultimately prevail. That's both a Christmas promise and a Christmas hope. In the months before the start of the war in Iraq, Pope John Paul II and the Vatican were among the strongest voices in the religious community opposing war. Archbishop Renato Martino, president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, issued a series of stronger and stronger statements. On March 11, 2003, contrasting the looming war with the first Gulf War that followed Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, he said that in this case, there is no aggression, and so this preventive war is, in itself, a war of aggression. A week later, 2 days before the war began, he upped the ante. It is a crime against peace that cries out with vengeance before God. Let us pray so that the Pharaoh's heart will not be hardened, and the biblical plagues of a terrible war will not fall on humanity. His and our prayers were not answered. Pharaoh's heart was hardened. War began, and more than a year later, the plague continues. More than 1,400 U.S. servicemen and women have died, along with tens of thousands of Iraqis. The reports of prison abuse by the U.S. military continue to unfold, and the administration now intends to ask Congress for additional funding to increase and maintain the U.S. military through the end of next year, while dramatically cutting vitally needed programs here at home. Before a meeting in Rome between President Bush and the Pope in June 2004, Cardinal Pio Longhi, the former U.S. Papal Nuncio who visited Bush in the spring of 2003 to personally deliver the Pope's message against war with Iraq, again spoke to an Italian newspaper. "Stop," is the cry expressed by the Church in the name of abused humanity. The Vatican Zenit News Service reported Cardinal Longhi saying, "The United States must also stop, and I think it has the strength to do so. It must re-establish respect for human beings and return to the family of nations, overcoming the temptation to act on its own. If it does not stop, the whirlwind of horror will involve other peoples and will lead us ever more to the abyss." Echoing growing calls for an end to the U.S. military occupation, the Cardinal concluded, "The forces present in Iraq not only must not be in fact under the command of the United States, but they must not even give the impression that they are. There should be a multilateral presence, which is not under those who organized and wanted the war. This was not a just war, and the recognition of that is the beginning of both moral and political wisdom, a necessary prerequisite to a better future. The use of the word empire in relation to American power in the world was once controversial, often restricted to left-wing critiques of U.S. hegemony. But now, on op-ed pages and in the nation's political discourse, the concepts of empire and even the phrase Pax Americana are increasingly mentioned in unapologetic ways. William Crystal, editor of the influential Weekly Standard, admits the aspiration to empire. If people want to say we're an imperial power, fine. Crystal is also chair of the Project for the New American Century, a group of conservative political figures who began in 1997 to chart a much more aggressive American foreign policy. In their own words, the project's papers lay out the vision of an American peace based on unquestioned U.S. military preeminence. These imperial visionaries write that America's grand strategy should aim to preserve and extend this advantageous position as far into the future as possible. There is nothing secret about all this. On the contrary, the views and plans of these powerful men have been quite open. These are far-right American political leaders and commentators who ascended to governing power, and, after the trauma of September 11, 2001, have been emboldened to carry out their agenda. In the run-up to the war with Iraq, Crystal told me that Europe was now unfit to lead because it was corrupted by secularism, as was the developing world, which was corrupted by poverty. Only the United States could provide the moral framework to govern a new world order, according to Crystal, who recently and candidly wrote, "Well, what's wrong with dominance in the service of sound principles and high ideals?" But whose principles and ideals? The American right wing's definition of American principles and ideals? To this aggressive extension of American power in the world, President George W. Bush adds God, and that changes the picture dramatically. It's one thing for a nation to assert its raw dominance in the world. It's quite another to suggest, as this president does, that the success of American military and foreign policy is connected to a religiously inspired mission, and even that his presidency may be a divine appointment for a time such as this. Many of the president's critics make the mistake of charging that his faith is insincere at best, a hypocrisy at worst, and mostly a political cover for his right-wing agenda. I don't doubt that George W. Bush's faith is sincere and deeply held. The real question is the content and meaning of that faith, and how it impacts his administration's domestic and foreign policies. George Bush reports a life-changing conversion, around the age of 40, from being a nominal Christian to a born-again believer, a personal transformation that ended his drinking problems, solidified his family life, and gave him a sense of direction. He changed his denominational affiliation from his parents' Episcopal faith to his wife's Methodism. Bush's personal faith helped prompt his interest in promoting his compassionate conservatism and the faith-based initiative as part of his administration. The real theological question about George W. Bush was whether he would make a pilgrimage from being essentially a self-help Methodist to a social reform Methodist. God had changed his life in real ways, but would his faith deepen to embrace the social activism of John Wesley, the great English preacher and founder of Methodism, who said poverty was not only a matter of personal choices, but also of social oppression and injustice? Would Bush's God of the 12-step program also become the God who required social justice and challenged the status quo of the wealthy and powerful, the God of whom the biblical prophet spoke? Then came September 11, 2001. Bush's compassionate conservatism and faith-based initiative rapidly gave way to his newfound vocation as the commander-in-chief of the war against terrorism. Close friends say that after 9/11, Bush found his mission in life. The self-help Methodist slowly became a messianic Calvinist, promoting America's mission to rid the world of evil. His administration has launched a new doctrine of preemptive war, has fought two wars, and now issues regular demands and threats to other potential enemies. After September 11th, nations around the world responded to America's pain. Even the French newspaper Le Monde carried the headline, "We are all Americans now." But the new preemptive and, mostly critically, unilateral foreign policy America now pursues has squandered much of that international support. President Bush has made numerous references to his belief that he could not be president if he did not believe in a divine plan that supersedes all human plans. As he gained political power, George Bush has increasingly seen his presidency as part of that divine plan. Every Christian hopes to find a vocation and calling in the world that is faithful to Christ. But a president who believes that the nation is fulfilling a God-given righteous mission and that he serves with a divine appointment can be quite theologically unsettling. Theologian Martin Marty voices the concerns of many when he says, "The problem isn't with Bush's sincerity, but with his evident conviction that he's doing God's will." The Bush theology that is emerging deserves to be examined on biblical grounds. Is it really Christian or merely American? Does it take a global view of God's world, or does it just assert the newest incarnation of American nationalism in an update of manifest destiny? Is it compassionate and humble, as the campaigning George W. Bush said that American domestic and foreign policy should be, respectively? How does the rest of the world view America's imperial ambition? Most important, how does the rest of the church worldwide see it? For when the White House waxes theological, its theology will be viewed as representative of the church. Since September 11th, hardly a week goes by without President Bush speaking of evil and evildoers. He has turned the White House bully pulpit into a pulpit indeed, replete with calls and missions and charges to keep regarding America's role in the world. George Bush is convinced that we are engaged in a moral battle between good and evil, and that those who are not with us are on the wrong side in that divine confrontation. But who are we? Does no evil reside with us? The problem of evil is a classic one in Christian theology and in age-old Western philosophy. Clearly, the existence of evil in the world is real in the biblical worldview. Indeed, anybody who could not see the real face of evil in the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, is suffering from a bad case of postmodern relativism. To fail to speak of evil in the world today is to engage in bad theology. But to speak of them being evil and us being good, that evil is all out there, and that in the warfare between good and evil, others are either with us or against us, is also bad theology. Unfortunately, it has become the Bush theology. What is most missing in this theology is any acknowledgement of the truth of one of the biblical passages that George Bush liked to quote before September 11th, but hasn't mentioned since. Matthew's Gospel says, "Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye? Or how can you say to your neighbor, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' while the log is in your eye, you hypocrite? First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye." The question about terrorism that has become unpatriotic to ask in America is, why do they hate us? President Bush strongly replies that our enemies hate us because of our values, our freedoms, and our way of life. There is some truth to the fact that some radical Islamic fundamentalists hate Western freedoms, but many people around the world don't hate America or Americans, but they do hate our policies in many places where they conflict with our best values and ideals. And when those policies are presented with a theological backdrop, it reflects poorly on the American church. Even Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention was quoted in the Washington Post as saying, "We should always remember that Bush is commander-in-chief, not theologian-in-chief." A simplistic "we are right and they are wrong" theology covers over the opportunity for self-reflection and correction. It also covers over the crimes America has committed, which led to widespread global resentment against us. It allows Elliot Abrams, a key member of the Bush National Security Council, to not have to answer questions about his and the Reagan administration's support for death squads in El Salvador, U.S. mercenaries committing atrocities in Nicaragua, or American-backed military dictatorships in Guatemala and so many other places around the world, which have killed untold thousands. It allows Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld to never have to answer why they and the U.S. government supported Saddam Hussein in his brutal war with Iran, using weapons of mass destruction. It covers over a less than even-handed U.S. Middle East policy that inflames Arab people everywhere. And it doesn't explain the seeming contradictions of our intervening in Iraq to liberate an oppressed people, but not in so many other places, like numerous sub-Saharan African countries, where the death toll and number of human rights violations are as high or higher, but where there is no oil or geopolitical significance. In Christian theology, it is not nations that rid the world of evil. They are too often caught up in it, in complicated webs of political power, economic interests, cultural clashes, and nationalist dreams. The confrontation with evil is a role reserved for God, using imperfect people, churches, and nations as God wills. But God has not given the responsibility for overcoming evil to any nation state, much less a superpower with enormous wealth and particular national interests. To continue to confuse the roles of God and the church with those of the American nation, as George Bush seems to do repeatedly, is a serious theological error that some might say borders on idolatry or blasphemy. In early 2004, the world was shocked at the release of photos showing the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by American and British soldiers. The painful irony escaped nobody. After going to war to liberate the Iraqi people from the brutality of Saddam Hussein and his torture chambers, some of the liberators were now accused of brutalizing and torturing Iraqi detainees in the same Abu Ghraib prison used by Saddam. The photos showed the horrible details: prisoners severely beaten, stripped naked and humiliated, sexually threatened, deprived of sleep, psychologically intimidated, and perhaps even killed. Pictures of a hooded inmate with wires attached to his body have traveled around the world, especially the Arab world. Forcing nude prisoners to pile up in human pyramids for picture-taking and verbal abuse is perceived as especially degrading in the Muslim honor-shame culture. In discussing the obscene photos, conservative columnist George Will wrote that we Americans should not flinch from this fact, that pornography is, almost inevitably, part of what empire looks like. It does not always look like that, and does not only look like that. But empire is about domination. Domination for self-defense, perhaps. Domination for the good of the dominated, arguably. But domination. That is an honest admission. Christian theology is uneasy with empire, and the pictures from Abu Ghraib prison reveal why. More than just politics is at stake in this scandal. More theology is also involved, and that is worthy of serious public discussion, especially when this war's commander-in-chief speaks often of his Christian faith. The Christian view of human nature and of sin suggests that we are fallible creatures and thus not good at empire. We cannot be trusted with domination, becoming too easily corrupted by its power and too often succumbing to repression and defending it. Therefore, we should not simply be shocked at the evil we have seen in the horrible prison photos, but also be sobered and saddened by that same potential in ourselves. History teaches that domination can make good people do bad things. The British did horrible things in Northern Ireland, the French in Algeria, and the Americans in Vietnam. Brutality is inevitably the consequence of occupation and domination, and is an enduring part of the cycle of violence. In Iraq, young Americans are being shot at and blown up every day. The frustration and anger at being daily targets is enormous. However, to set the conditions for the interrogation of prisoners that might yield critical intelligence and perhaps relieve some of that frustration, both soldiers and commanders clearly crossed the line. Now, the detainee scandal is distracting attention from another equally alarming consequence of this dangerous occupation: a growing tolerance for civilian casualties in U.S. counterinsurgency military operations. Again, the memory of Vietnam haunts. The fundamental theological issues in the Iraqi prisoner abuse story and the increase of civilian casualties in this war involve the nature of occupation itself and domination as the consequence of empire, the strategy that appears to be the Bush administration's unapologetic choice for fighting terrorism. Brutality is the predictable consequence of domination, the inevitable result of empire, and an enduring part of the cycle of violence. Christian theology suggests that domination is oppressive and corrupting for both the dominated and the dominator. In preferring the virtues of human dignity, justice, and humility, Christianity implicitly teaches that empire is not the best strategy to fight terrorism. In fact, the domination policies of empire often make terrorism worse by producing tragic behaviors that terrorists use to fuel their murderous agendas. The pictures from Abu Ghraib have already become recruiting posters for the next generation of terrorists in the Muslim world. The question of moral agency has been much discussed in regard to the Abu Ghraib scandal. Just who is responsible for the horrific pictures and widespread reports of prisoner humiliation, illegal treatment, torture, perhaps even murder at American hands? From a religious perspective, those soldiers who abuse detainees should be held morally and legally accountable, even if they claim to have only followed orders. If there were such orders, commanders should be held even more culpable. Both common sense and the dynamics of how sin operates in human beings and their institutions suggest that the patterns of abuse reported by the International Red Cross and human rights organizations are most likely true. We are learning that a climate of official toleration and even encouragement may have created pressure for young military police to soften up prisoners for interrogation. National reflection on this scandal will be of little worth unless it takes us deeper than revulsion against bad apples that taint the reputation of the military. We need more than investigations initiated by the chain of command into prison policies and atmosphere, and more than decisions about how high accountability should go, whether it be to military intelligence, the Secretary of Defense, or even the Oval Office. We must also address the bad theology that contributes to the problems of domination and empire. When the White House promulgates an official theology of righteous empire in which they are evil and we are good, and if you are not with us, you are on the side of the evildoers, it contributes to an atmosphere that makes abuse more likely. And when leaders from the American religious right describe Islam as an evil religion, they are, however indirectly, helping to set conditions for the abuse of Muslim detainees. Abuse and torture are always more likely when the victims are objectified, made into an other that is somehow different and less human than we are. The religious conviction that challenges us to see the image of God in every person is an absolute barrier to the practice of torture. It is also a moral foundation for international accords like the Geneva Convention. President George Bush is a Christian, but he did not listen to U.S. and world church leaders who overwhelmingly opposed the war in Iraq and who warned about many of the plagues of war, to use the language of the Vatican, that have transpired since. Perhaps President Bush should listen to religious leaders now. American domination and empire are both bad policy and bad theology, and they will not succeed in Iraq. Only international initiative and authority have a chance of repairing the damage now. The United States must make the major contribution it clearly owes to reconstruction in Iraq, but only under somebody else's leadership. The domination of empire must be abandoned. The real theological problem in America today is no longer the religious right, but the nationalist religion of the Bush administration, one that confuses the identity of the nation with the church, and God's purposes with the mission of American empire. America's foreign policy is more than preemptive. It is theologically presumptuous, not only unilateral, but dangerously messianic, not just arrogant, but rather bordering on the idolatrous and blasphemous. George Bush's personal faith has prompted a profound self-confidence in his mission to fight the axis of evil, his call to be commander-in-chief in the war against terrorism, and his definition of America's responsibility to defend the hopes of all mankind. This is a dangerous mix of bad foreign policy and bad theology. But the answer to bad theology is not secularism, it's good theology. It is not always wrong to invoke the name of God and the claims of religion in the public life of a nation, as some secularists say. Where would we be without the moral prophecy of Martin Luther King Jr., who held his Bible in one hand and his Constitution in the other as he preached, holding us to our best values? Can anyone deny the prophetic leadership of Archbishops Desmond Tutu in South Africa and Oscar Romero in El Salvador? In our own American history, religion has been lifted up for public life in two different ways, as we discussed earlier. One invokes the name of God and faith in order to hold us accountable to God's intentions, to call us to justice, compassion, humility, repentance, and reconciliation. Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, and Martin Luther King perhaps best exemplify that way. The other way wrongly invokes God's blessing on our activities, agendas, and purposes. Many presidents and political leaders have used the language of religion in such ways, and George W. Bush is falling into that same temptation. Lincoln regularly used the language of Scripture, but in a way that called both sides in the Civil War to contrition and repentance. Jefferson said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." It's easy to vilify the enemy and claim that we are on the side of God and good, but repentance is better. Christians should always live uneasily with empire, which constantly threatens to become idolatrous and substitute secular purposes for God's. After all, the first empire that Christians faced was the Roman Empire. American Christians now have to make some difficult choices. Will we stand in solidarity with the worldwide church, the international body of Christ, or with our own American government? It's not a surprise to note that the global church does not generally support the foreign policy goals of the Bush administration, whether in Iraq, the Middle East, or the wider war on terrorism. Only from inside some of our U.S. churches does one find religious voices consonant with the visions of American empire. Once there was first century Rome. Now there is a new Rome. Once there were first century barbarians. Now there are many barbarians who are the Saddams of this world. And then there were the Christians who were loyal, not to Rome, but only to the kingdom of God. To whom will the Christians be loyal today? In a world on fire with ethnic conflict, rogue states, and terrorist violence, the traditional Christian doctrines of pacifism and just war are undergoing severe challenges. After years of debates about war, we now confront new adversaries much more difficult to deal with. The new enemy of terrorism is revealing the limits of both our traditional pacifist and just war positions. Standing above or apart from terrible violence that costs so much in human lives is not morally tenable. And a pacifism that objects to war without having answers to the very real threats of horrific violence, sponsored either by international networks of terror or states, isn't very helpful in today's world. Nor is classical just war doctrine particularly relevant in this battle. It simply isn't enough to offer endless academic scrutiny of criteria for fighting wars, but not actually preventing any. Just war thinking has few answers to new forms of violence that are not as vulnerable to traditional warfighting methods. And just war arguments are becoming increasingly suspect when critical judgments become more dependent on technology than morality. The real question today is how to resolve the conflicts, how to reduce the violence, how to heal the causes of war, and most critically, how to defeat terrorism. Maybe a new approach is called for. Will the world just see the churches arguing about war or actually doing the things that make for peace? The challenge to nonviolence today is clear. If nonviolence is to have any credibility, it must answer the questions that violence purports to answer, but in a better way. Saying no to violence is good, but having alternatives is better. What does real peacemaking look like in our world? And what are the initiatives and institutions that could become alternatives to both war and terrorist violence by resolving the inevitable conflicts that lead to them? Where are the most hopeful signs today of peacemaking that is actually making a difference? We always should be reminded that Jesus did not say, "Blessed are the peace lovers," which of course everybody claims to be. He rather said, "Blessed are the peacemakers," which is always a much more difficult task. History, especially recent history, is demonstrating an abundance of practical, nonviolent strategies, techniques, and practices that are yielding positive results. Nonviolent victories against the tyrannies of communism in Eastern Europe, overthrowing military regimes in Latin America, and bringing down powerful dictators like Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines and Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, have shown great promise and possibilities for the future. Various strategies of nonviolent resistance have actually proven to be more effective than counterviolence and war in bringing down oppressive regimes. The idea that such powerful states are simply too brutal for nonviolence to work has been proven false. The path of active peacemaking is where we are likely to find the alternatives to war and violence that are so desperately needed in a world full of terrorists, terrorist states, unilateralist superpowers, and weapons of mass destruction. This has been a very difficult time for Christian peacemakers who believe that following Jesus leads to the path of nonviolence. Despite the great challenges to that commitment in light of new terrorist violence, I am still committed to active nonviolence. But since September 11th, we've all had to go deeper to understand what real peacemaking might require of us. The September 11th terrorists murdered 3,000 people in one day, and they did so with a cruel intentionality. That those people were civilians mattered nothing to the mass murderers. While President Bush's morally simplistic good versus evil rhetoric is spiritually dangerous, America has hardly been good given the above litany of wrongdoing, and inability to see the stark face of evil in the events of September 11th is indeed a moral failure. Our postmodern and politically correct world has had a hard time naming evil, but Christians shouldn't. This was a horrific crime against humanity. Although I oppose the language and tactics of war in this campaign against terrorism, the task of preventing further terrorist violence against innocent people is a very worthy goal, and the self-defense of Americans and other people is clearly at stake here. If there is a good and necessary purpose in defeating terrorism, and if the lives of my neighbors and my family are indeed at risk, how do I respond? While terrorists use and manipulate American global injustices to justify their crimes and to recruit the angry and desperate for their violent purposes, they have no interest in the international justice and peace that many of us have lived and fought for. Indeed, they are its mortal enemies. The terrorists' vision for the world is oppressive. They would destroy democracy, deny human rights, repress women, and persecute people of other faiths and even those of their own religion who disagree with them. Even worse, they blaspheme the name of God by doing their violent work in the name of religion. We are in a new situation. The fight against terrorism is indeed a moral cause, unlike many U.S. foreign policy goals in the Cold War period. Yet this battle will not likely be won with the traditional methods of war. Indeed, fighting a succession of endless wars against Muslim countries will only exacerbate the spread of terrorism and claim many innocent lives at the same time. What then shall we do? We must advocate the mobilization of the most extensive international and diplomatic pressure the world has ever seen against the bin Ladens of the world and their networks of terror, focusing the world's political will, intelligence capabilities, security systems, legal intervention, multinational policing, and finally, swift and sure international law enforcement against terrorism. The international community must also dry up the terrorist financial networks, isolate them politically, discredit them before international tribunals, and expose the ugly brutality behind their terror. International law must be empowered to act as never before and authorized to be the primary global instrument against terrorism. The adjudicatory capacities and enforcement mechanisms of international law are the best alternative we have to the dangerous and counterproductive strategy of endless war. That may now be our choice: either multinational cooperation under the rule of international law, or the unilateral preemptive wars of the world superpower. Choosing the first course over the second is not only the best political wisdom, it is also a theological imperative. Unilateral American wars against terrorism cannot conform to the ethics of just war. Aggressive multinational legal enforcement could. And such international legal action could also be the alternative to war that pacifists have always sought. Such international and collective action should not be regarded as weak, but rather may be the only thing strong and effective enough to defeat terrorism. But when the international community has spoken, tried, and found terrorists guilty, and authorized their apprehension and incarceration, we will still have to confront the ethical dilemmas involved in enforcing those measures. Terrorists must be found, captured, and stopped, and their violent plans must be disrupted before they are carried out. All this involves using some kind of force. To accept any use of force is a very difficult thing for those committed to nonviolent solutions. Is any kind of force consistent with nonviolence? If so, what kind? What limitations are required? What ethical considerations must be brought to bear? Most nonviolence advocates, even pacifists, support the role of police in protecting people in their neighborhoods. We call the police if we or our families were under attack. Can we effectively apply this to the international situation? Perhaps it is time to explore a theology for global police forces, including ethics for the use of internationally sanctioned enforcement, precisely as an alternative to war. Since September 11th, I've talked to a wide range of Christian peacemakers. Some are delving into Dietrich Bonhoeffer's painful decision as a pacifist to join the plot to assassinate Hitler. Others are rereading French theologian Jacques Ellul, who explained his decision to support the resistance movement against Nazism by appealing to the necessity of violence, but wasn't willing to call such recourse Christian. Many are going back to Gandhi and asking what he meant when he said that nonviolent resistance is the best thing, but that violent resistance to evil is better than no resistance at all. Some believe that there can be no forceful resistance to terrorism, either because of American foreign policy sins or because of their principled pacifism. Others are only willing to deal with root causes and continue to oppose the American foreign policy that, in their view, is behind this terrorism. They point out the true fact that the United States has itself been guilty of sponsoring or supporting state terrorism, a painful reality I've observed in the Palestinian West Bank and Gaza, occupied by Israeli defense forces. But many practitioners of Christian peacemaking, including myself, can't accept such a non-response to horrific terrorism, despite the history of U.S. foreign policy. I believe we must find a way to deal with the threat of terrorism, a threat that must not be avoided or minimized by those committed to nonviolence. We cannot turn away from this. In the crisis over terrorism, Christians must continue to defend the innocent from military reprisals, prevent dangerous and wider wars, and oppose superpower unilateralism. But we must also help stop the bin Ladens, their networks of violence, and the threat they pose to everything we love and value. I am increasingly convinced that the way forward may be found in the wisdom gained in the practice of conflict resolution and the energy of a faith-based commitment to peacemaking. Indeed, the number of people, projects, and institutions experimenting in nonviolent methods of conflict resolution has been growing steadily over the past decade. The Bush administration chose the course of unilateral war instead of international law in its war on terrorism. In Afghanistan, more civilians were killed than the number of Americans who died on September 11th. And outside of Kabul, the country is reverting back to control of warlords and even Taliban resurgence. Iraq is now a place of violent insurgency, political chaos, and concentrated terrorism, while even administration officials admit that the terrorist threats to the United States may now be even greater than before September 11th. Bin Laden is still at large, his networks are more dispersed, and close observers report that a new generation of terrorists has come of age and is now operational. Indeed, terrorists from other countries are now in Iraq, where their bombings of civilians are exacerbating the already violent situation. War as a tactic in the war against terrorism has not succeeded. It can now be argued that the Iraq War may ultimately make the defeat of terrorism more difficult because of the division it caused among key allies, the deeper resentment it has triggered in Muslim countries, and the failure of the war to produce the promises of democracy in Iraq or the beginning of a Middle East peace agreement, which seems further away than ever. The war in Iraq has proved to be a great distraction and diversion from the fight against terrorism, rather than a necessary component. Pope John Paul II vigorously opposed the U.S. war in Iraq. He said it was the wrong way to defeat terrorism. Yet on Easter Sunday, 2004, the Pope called upon the world to unite in overcoming terrorism and to resist its logic of death. Reject war, but unite to defeat terrorism. That is a message for our time. No one has all the answers. But humility is a good trait for Christian peacemakers, while self-righteousness is both spiritually inappropriate and politically self-defeating. This much is clear. Jesus calls us to be peacemakers, not just peace lovers. That will inevitably call us to face hard questions with no easy answers. In the end, Christian peacemaking is more a path than a position. From ashes you have come. To ashes you shall return. Repent and follow Christ. With these traditional words from the Ash Wednesday liturgy, the sign of the cross was placed on the foreheads of Sojourner's staff members at our midday prayer service. But these special ashes came from a burned-out house in the West Bank, recently shelled by the Israeli army. I had recently returned from a trip to Israel and Palestine. After clearing customs at the Tel Aviv airport, I rode the 35 miles to Jerusalem, where I attended the International Peace Conference convened by the Sabeel Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center. Everywhere I looked were enormous Israeli settlements, always on the highest ground, with the most modern, first-world living conditions anywhere, towering over the much poorer Palestinian villages down in the valleys. I saw on this trip how Israeli settlements now loom over the West Bank and Gaza, and likewise loom over the chances for peace in the Middle East. They are the facts on the ground that shape virtually everything about Middle East politics today. Long before he became prime minister, Ariel Sharon controlled the future as the chief architect of the settlement policy. Settlements are aggressive forays into Palestinian territory by people who believe that God has given them all the land. Each one makes lasting peace that much more difficult. It's obvious now that this was the intent of the policy from the beginning. Israeli soldiers are in the West Bank and Gaza, not to keep law and order, not to protect Palestinians from violence or crime, but only to protect the settlements and the settlers. Control the roads, control movement, control the daily life of the entire Palestinian population. That's the consequence of the settlements policy. Most people in the Middle East and elsewhere have accepted the logic of a two-state solution and the formula of land for peace. But after days of watching, listening, and talking to both Palestinians and Israelis, I began to feel that the peace process had now become, as Palestinian leader Jean Zarou described, the structure for our domination. The more I saw, the more it reminded me of apartheid in South Africa. There is no contiguous Palestinian territory in the West Bank or Gaza. No such thing as a Palestinian state, nor one in the making. There are only pieces of Palestinian territory, with Israel controlling everything in between. American Rabbi Michael Lerner says the situation is as if somebody took your house away, the way Israel took Palestinian land in the 1967 war, and then says they'll give you parts of your house back. But they still control the hallways and the bathrooms. Palestinians can't get from one bedroom to another without going through a hallway controlled by the Israelis. As long as the settlements remain, the only possibility is disconnected territories housing the Palestinian workers who service the Israeli state. The Israeli policy is called closure. Everything gets closed down in the West Bank and Gaza, and Palestinians are not allowed to move freely, to go to school, to work, or even to visit family. Of course, this is not all one-sided. There is indeed Palestinian violence against Israeli settlements. Shots and mortar shells have been aimed into them. Many Jews have been killed, and the fear is very high. There have even been casualties among Israeli children. Two 14-year-old boys were found dead in a cave near their settlement, their bodies battered and mutilated with rocks, killed by Palestinians. And the world has seen the results of suicide bombers in Tel Aviv restaurants and discos, suburban shopping malls, and even Israeli school buses. Israeli parents, no matter what their views on peace, now live in fear each time their children go to school or their teenagers go out at night. We have been horrified by graphic pictures of the bodies of Jewish children blown to bits. From a moral perspective, attacks against civilian populations are terrorism, no matter their source, and regardless of their political motivation or grievances. Such terror can never be morally justified. Never. But the Israelis regularly use such incidents to justify shelling Palestinians in massive, disproportionate retaliation. They've even resorted to bombing Palestinian targets with F-16 fighter planes. The casualties are enormous, including Palestinian children and infants caught in the middle of attacks in retaliation for terrorism. Such deliberate and lethal violence against civilians must also be called terrorism. There is no symmetry in the violence of the Middle East today. Israeli violence is enormously disproportionate to Palestinian violence. That includes the violence of the settlements and closure policies themselves, and the violence of Israeli military practices, especially in their retaliation against Palestinian attacks. Despite this lack of proportionality, there is no moral or strategic justification for the terrorist Palestinian violence targeted against civilians in response to Israeli domination. No argument, even lack of symmetry, will suffice. But there still are courageous voices in the Middle East calling for nonviolence. Amid the downward spiral of violence and counterviolence, a growing conversation in the Middle East, the United States, and Europe suggests that only new initiatives of nonviolence may now be able to redress the deadly despair of the current deadlock. The violent extremists on both sides of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict seem to have a symbiotic relationship. The Hamas terrorists and the right-wing Likud party ideologues seem to need each other. And many have pointed out that a disciplined Palestinian movement of nonviolent civil disobedience could be Ariel Sharon's worst nightmare. But as Gandhi often pointed out, nonviolent movements still have casualties, a painful fact that could be especially likely in any confrontation with the Israeli Defense Forces. It is far too early to say whether such discussions will lead to significant action that might make a difference for peace, but in the Middle East, one discovers a growing number of people and organizations committed to nonviolence. These are the fragile signs of hope. At one point, I visited the Christian Peacemaker Team, CPT, in Hebron, one of the most conflicted areas in the West Bank. The Jewish settlements are actually inside the city of Hebron, so there are street confrontations nearly every day. The only force between the warring factions is the CPT, which consists mostly of Americans and Canadians from the historic peace churches. Days are spent offering presence, relationship, and accompaniment for those who need it. For example, a group of Palestinians were on their way to the mosque for worship, and Israeli soldiers stood in their way. The Muslims went to their knees to pray, refusing to disperse, and the Israelis trained their guns, apparently about to open fire on an unarmed crowd. A 23-year-old American woman and a young man from Canada, both from the CPT, jumped in front of the soldiers with their arms spread and cried, "Please, these are unarmed people, do not shoot them." That stopped the soldiers from shooting, but the Israeli military put the two CPTers in jail for the night. But when they came back to the city the next day,